Hi, Rodney.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I can't complain. Let me introduce this. I am Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You're Rodney Smith, very well-known meditation teacher, formerly a Buddhist monk. You were ordained as a monk some time ago, although your background right now suggests that your monastic days may be behind you. It doesn't look like a monastery.
Very far behind me.
Okay. But you're in Seattle probably right now, right?
I am, yes. Uh-huh.
Which is your headquarters.
It is my home.
It is your home. You've written a couple of books. The most recent book is called Awakening, A Paradigm Shift of the Heart.
Yes.
Previously, you wrote Stepping Out of Self-Deception.
Yes.
But Awakening was just published. And in addition to all that, we should say, by way of full disclosure, that you were the teacher at a meditation retreat I attended in late 2013.
Yes, I corrupted your mind.
You tried. You tried. I've got to say, I've actually been on two of your retreats, and I've been fascinated by a couple of things. One is, I think you delve more deeply than many meditation teachers into Buddhist doctrine, including some somewhat arcane stuff that's not all that easy to grasp. And the second thing that intrigues me about you is your sheer intensity. Have you heard this before, that as meditation teachers go, you're pretty intense, man?
Passionate. I like to call it passion.
Well, I don't know. I would say it includes passion, but you did remind me of some of these Southern Baptist preachers of my youth that scared the hell out of me. Yeah, exactly. It's like.
I'll try to lighten up.
You are there to make the sale. You are there to liberate us. Okay, so this newest book, Awakening. Now, I know you don't mean to confine your audience to Buddhists, and I don't think you want the term awakening construed in a strictly Buddhist context, but Buddhism is much of your background. So could you start by telling us, what does the term awakening mean to a Buddhist, or what would it have meant to the Buddha?
Okay, so if you look at how we live, most of us live with fundamental assumptions on which we don't ever question. Those assumptions of those functions really are derived from the perceptions we have of the world, mm-hmm, and of ourselves within the world. And they're very basic to the way we see the world. And that assumption is the sense of me being here and objects external to me, and that somehow I have to gather those objects together in order for me to have some pleasure and to distance myself from objects in where there could be some danger. Mm-hmm. Well, this way of thinking, this perceptual way of understanding life, has its roots, I believe, in the evolutionary development of us as a species. When we were just coming out onto the plains of Serengeti or wherever we were, we didn't have much going for us in terms of survival. In fact, we weren't very fast. We weren't very ferocious. So we were sort of at the bottom of the food chain. Something had to develop in us quickly so that we could survive. And what developed in us, I believe, is the ability to cognize, the ability to conceptualize the world. So now, instead of seeing a stick, we saw a spear. And once we could see a stick as a spear, we could then use it for survival. In that sense, the conceptualization of the world meant that as a species, we could go from the bottom of the food chain to the top of the food chain in one quick movement.
Okay, so this sense of, you're talking about a sense of separation,
kind of,
from the rest of the world. Well, you're talking about kind of two things, a sense of separation between you and the rest of the world, and then dividing that world up into these discrete objects, kind of, right?
Yes, which we had to do.
Yeah, so you're tracing that to kind of the evolution of abstract thought.
Right.
Now, I mean, I assume you usually get some pushback from some people already, even before you get to why it is we see the world like this, right? Doesn't the average person say to you, I mean, what are you talking about? Of course there are objects out there. Of course you're separate from me. What do you even mean to suggest anything else?
Okay, so, well, it's a very good question, and that's really where the spiritual journey begins. But it's also where science is pointing us. I like to dovetail the two, because oftentimes science will show us a direction that we have yet to realize in our own life. And if you look at science in its late 20th century, early 21st century form, it's beginning to question the solidity of objects. It's beginning to question the distance between objects. It's beginning to throw the whole thing into question. And some beautiful quotes that I have in this book really do show you that science is no longer holding the partial vision of us being separate from the world in which we are interacting through and to. So first to understand that science is questioning, and then to say, okay, so the world I see is very distant and separate. Why is it that I see the world in this way? To be willing to question those assumptions are now questioning the very foundation on which we live. We like to ask questions from those assumptions, but we don't like to ask questions about those assumptions. The spiritual journey is asking questions about those basic premises on which our perceptions are based. So when we start saying, okay, look, what does it mean that I feel like I'm here and the world is out there? As we introspectively look at what it is that how we have organized our thoughts, so that we perceive or conceive the world external to us, we begin to see in the Buddhist frame of reference that the images we hold are separate from the realities we see, but the reality we see has no separation in its essence. It's the image or the idea that we have about the reality that seems to hold us separate from it.
Okay, can I stop you? You mentioned Buddhism. Yeah. And, you know, I said, what does awakening mean to a Buddhist? And I expected you to say somewhere along the line something about the liberation from suffering, maybe, or use the word enlightenment. I mean, that is, to a Buddhist, that is a big part of the payoff from seeing the world clearly, right? There's this idea in Buddhism, yeah. If you see the world clearly as it truly is, you will be liberated from suffering. You will also become a better person because you'll become more considerate toward other people. So I gather you're saying that, well, probably in Buddhism, but certainly in your view, the source of our suffering has something to do with our perception that we are divorced from the rest of the world?
Yes. The Buddhist continuum from conventional reality to spiritual union is the continuum of suffering to the end of suffering. I don't think that continuum works so well in modern day. And it's a beautiful continuum, and it has all the subtleties you need. But I think that there are other continuums that can overlay upon this that show us the problem in more exact form. For instance, we can talk about from noise to stillness. That covers the same continuum as the Buddhist continuum from suffering to not suffering. How do I mean that? The noisier we are inside, the more distant and separate and contentious we are with reality, the more we're going to have a conflictual relationship with reality. So the quieter we become, the less we separate ourselves away from the very object that we are seeing, and the closer and unified reality becomes. So I think that if we put a different continuum than suffering to the end of suffering, although it holds those same qualities, we can begin to see how we may have misinterpreted the Buddhist direction of suffering to the end of suffering. End of suffering really doesn't mean for most people that the paradigm shifts at all. It's just the paradigm that we're in gets easier. I'm now quiet, I'm now calm, I'm not as reactive, and I'm more equanimous. Those are the qualities we believe are the enlightened qualities of mind. But for me, from my point of view, it's really a change of paradigms that has to occur for full awakening to be realized.
So it would lead to less suffering, more equanimity.
Yes.
It would lead to these things.
And, yes.
But you're saying you need to focus on this fundamental perceptual shift. But it seems to me that the perceptual shift itself is also in Buddhist doctrine, right? Something very much like this.
Yeah, but it remains a doctrine. It's like everybody knows no self is part of the three characteristics of existence, you know, along with change and suffering. But it remains a kind of... We can keep ourselves very safe from the sense of no self. It's something that we're working towards.
Right.
But as we're working towards it, we're applying the same strategies we had while we believed in ourselves. And we think that the way we're working towards non-self, the same strategies which have built ourselves to be what they are going to somehow show us a moment in which no self is the fact, is the reality. And in fact, it doesn't work like that. Okay. You can't apply the same strategies that formed yourself to end yourself.
Okay, we should pause and say, for those who are not conversant in these matters, one of the Buddha's ideas is that the self, in some sense, does not exist. The various parts of your mind that you think of as yourself, as belonging to you, are actually not self. And this is a fundamental teaching. It's kind of argued over exactly how to interpret it. But in any event, you're saying that most of this is bad news for all those people in meditation halls across America who think they're getting closer to grasping what this counterintuitive sounding doctrine really means, and they're going to get to the moment when they feel at last that they don't have a self. You're telling us they're going about it the wrong way.
Yeah, I don't think I would be quite as abrupt as that, but I would suggest a change of views, and even the sense of distance. You see, the sense of self, if I'm here and you're there, holds the concept of distance and time. If I have an object outside of me, I have to travel a certain distance to get to it, which takes a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
We conceive of our spiritual journey along those same ways. There's here I am, poor me, that is unenlightened, and I have to travel a certain way, a certain distance, applying certain strategies until I get to this particular. The paradigm that we enter upon awakening really shows the falseness of time, space, and separation.
And you've been there. I mean, you've had this feeling yourself during meditation. I don't know if you have it now, but you have had this fundamental perception that this is the real reality.
Well, I think, I mean, I don't want to separate myself out from everyone else. I think that we all have had intimations of something more than what we have taken life to be, and something more than we have taken ourselves to be. And so there are these moments in which we're not trying to get away from ourselves, in which we're not trying to apply certain strategies that are productive and useful, that will lead to a certain spiritual direction, when we're just quiet, when we're being still in ourselves, that suddenly the shift of perspective, the shift of paradigms occurs. We take that as something that we did in preparation for this insight to arise. But really what happened was we were still enough so that the reality and its true manifestation arose within that stillness. Okay? So instead of trying to reproduce what we did to get there, the better way to do that is just to be still, just to be quiet with whatever is arising. Offer no contentiousness to it. Offer no reaction to it.
Okay.
And this
sounds a little like something that actually is fairly commonly taught at meditation retreats. You know, first you focus on your breathing enough to kind of quiet your mind, and so you're doing less of the kind of chatter in your head, and you become still. You observe your interior, so to speak, as well as any sounds and things outside, and you get to a point where you're not reacting to them, and that can even include feelings. You might even include a feeling like anxiety, and then you realize it doesn't actually get the grip on you it normally gets. It arises, but then you just kind of let it be there. You observe it. So this part is sounding to me like fairly mainstream advice from a meditation teacher, right?
Yeah, you know, I really don't have any problems with how the method is taught. It's just it's not taught quite as far as I would like to have students go. It's still you who's having an equanimous moment. It's still you who is quieter now and less, and I'm suffering less. But shows you're in the right direction on the continuum.
Except for the you part. Except for the way you keep thinking of it as you.
That's exactly right. The you keeps what you're feeling separate from you, the person who's feeling it. And so, at some point, this thing has to all come together. That's what the spiritual is. The spiritual journey is to move from the forms and material and external way we see life to a unified formlessness that holds life. So but form never releases itself from the belief in form. We can't use form for the mechanism for our release. And that's what most of us are troubled within. We're contained within the idea that using form will somehow free us from the state of consciousness that is causing our suffering.
Okay. But I think, some meditators might react, like me, for example, might react to this by saying, okay, but I still don't get it. I mean, you make it sound as if it's easy to just let go of the idea of I. And, it's one thing. I mean, you might be able to talk me into the idea that the self doesn't exist as I normally think. That's one thing. But actually feeling it as true, is something I can't wish myself into, right? And as you say, it is something that people meditate for long periods of time, a point they may aspire to get to, even if a meditation teacher would say don't aspire to anything, they still might aspire to it. Some of them might say they've been there. I think you would say you've been there through meditation. You've had this experience that the self doesn't exist.
Yes.
And the question is, one question is, so like, if it's so easy, tell me in one sentence, what is the additional thing I have to do?
Well, that question is coming from the paradigm of suffering.
You're right about that.
Okay, so let's just look at this in terms of the evolution of understanding. Most of us start where most of us are. We're suffering, individuals suffering. And we play this thing as far as we can, keeping ourselves intact and downplaying and separating ourselves or learning to understand what suffering is. There reaches a point where our sensitivity to suffering exceeds our capacity to escape it through the normal ways and strategies that we've been applying. At that point, we have to turn back in and see if there is the very central issue of myself who is suffering is the main problem that inhibits further progress. So I'm not suggesting going there prior to our understanding that this is needed. There's a timeliness within this evolution that's healthy and for everyone. But most of us overstay that point. We keep practicing from the sense of self long after we've intuited that the sense of self is itself the problem. And it's at that point that where I'm coming in and suggesting a turning of our strategies, a turning around of the whole issue.
Okay.
So I really don't have any problem with meditation retreats, instructions as they're offered. I just don't think they go far enough. And I think there are many experienced meditators who have been practicing for a number of years who are ready to hear a different direction for their meditation. And that's what I'm trying to offer.
Okay, but there's no like advice you'd give me about while I'm meditating what to do. I mean, I know what you're saying. You're saying drop the part about the self.
Here's what I would suggest. I would suggest trying to be quiet with each and everything that happens in your mind and your body. Mm-hmm. Just be quiet with it. Okay, if I could just change the metaphor we're using. Because what the self is it's not a thing that has a mind. I don't have a mind. The sense of I is a part of the mind's display. It's a thought within the mind. But we play as if, we act as if it's outside the mind where I'm having a mind. I've got to do something about my mind. And so that idea of me being outside the mind, having a problem with my mind, is the very problem itself. And that, so that as long as even if I'm getting quieter in myself, and my mind's getting quieter. This is a very happy environment now. Still, the sense of me being separate from my mind is the basic division that creates the suffering, the subtlety of suffering as we adventure forth. So what has it, what about the fact, how about if I included the sense of me within the mental frame of reference? So I didn't put it outside, so that the sense of me was arising with my thoughts, with my emotions, with other physical sensations, other sense data, and in that quiet, so I wasn't trying. You see, as soon as I take objection to anything that's coming into the mind, now I'm off outside the mind having a problem with the mind. But if I'm just quiet with anything that arises within the mind, then there's no differentiation between me as the thought of I and the arising of whatever disturbance or mind state is occurring within the mind. Mm-hmm. So what I'm suggesting is being quiet with all things of the mind.
Okay.
Just being quiet.
Offer no resistance.
Offer no resistance.
Okay.
So let it make a, it needs to make a conceptual understanding. And we have to get this thing conceptually understood so that it makes sense to us.
On a sheerly conceptual level, there's a kind of irony here. On the one hand, I think you're saying, don't think of the suffering as belonging to you, which sounds like you're saying don't hold it so close. But on the other hand, you're also saying don't see a distance between yourself and the objects of your mind and the feelings. Is there a sense in which you're saying both of those things or not?
What I'm saying is that the sense of you is part of the mind's play. It's an idea. It's a mm-hmm. thought that comes up. I. Mm-hmm. We've just practiced it so long that we think somehow the I is separate from the mind's display, the states of mind that are arising. What if we include it, if we're quiet enough, so that we begin to see that it's part of the totality of the mind itself? Mm-hmm. Then the division that creates the suffering, it's the division, it's the mental division between me and what I want and what's being offered by the mind through the sense data, that's where suffering arises. If I close that separation, that division, and unify the mind so that everything is seen in its entirety as being a part of the mind, including the sense of me, there is no more suffering.
Okay, so here's one question. If you see this sense of I as just another part of your mind, it's like, there's some anxiety over here. There's this thought about what you're going to have for lunch tomorrow over here. There's this sense of I over here.
Right.
Well, if you're seeing the sense of I, from what vantage point, from what perspective are you seeing it? If you can't say, well, I'm seeing it because you just said no.
No. This is very important because this is the paradigm shift. Okay, so stay with me here. In the beginning of practice, it feels as if I'm the one that activates my mindfulness, my awareness. I can be mindful of my hand, my belly, my breath. It's me that initiates that, and I establish that attention and focus to whatever it is. As we mature in practice and begin to quiet ourselves, we begin to sense that this awareness pre-exists our effort. That even when we're not trying, we sense that it's around somewhere, okay? And as we get even quieter, we find that it pre-exists everything, that we can call it up. We can say, okay, I'm not moving from this moment. What is awareness here? You know, and you can call up the awareness rather than where our mind is focused. Instead of it being focused on the experience I'm having, you can focus the attention. The attention itself can become the active ingredient of the moment. And that doesn't have a placeholder. Okay, so I'm not saying it very well. Let me go back and say it in a different way. As we get quieter, we begin to see wherever we are that's forcing the issue of awareness is a thought or a placeholder in the mind. And as I get quieter, I see that as a placeholder. that which sees the placeholder of me forcing the issue of awareness, that which sees it is itself not a place. It's not a position. It's not a, there's not another eye behind it seeing me doing something. It's more 360. It's an entire encompassment of awareness around body and mind. And you, after a while, you get comfortable with that perception. Mm-hmm. So the eye doesn't fight that perception and tries to control the awareness anymore. It allows the awareness to be, to see itself. Okay? So there's no more new eye now. Mm-hmm. It's like, here's an example. If you take the air around you, all right, the air around you is 360. It's everywhere. It doesn't apply any pressure. It's there. Okay, now make the air awareness, alive. Mm-hmm. That's what it feels like. It feels like you're being surrounded internally and externally by something that is not self-generated, that's holding you, holds all things all the time, just like the air does. And therefore, you start releasing the need to create the tension between yourself and that which holds.
Okay.
So that's...
So in this view, awareness is a kind of a global or universal field.
Yes.
Ordinarily, you know, I by being a person, if you're a person, then you get to have, like, part of it, like, in your head, I guess. That's part of the deal.
You get to be in control.
You get to control part of the field of awareness.
Yes.
And you're saying, are you saying let go, release control of the field of your, don't be so possessive about your part of the field of awareness?
Yes. That's very well said. Better than I said it. Yes. That's exactly what I'm saying. It doesn't mean at times you don't need your attention to focus in on the book you're reading or the person you're meeting. So you use it, but you don't claim ownership of it.
Mm-hmm. And I'll say, I mean, this is going to, what I just said about a universal field of awareness is going to no doubt strike a lot of people as flaky. But I would say, in my own view, the problem of consciousness, the fact of consciousness, is such a difficult problem philosophically and a challenging one that, you know, kind of all bets are off. I mean, for example, Christoph Koch, a very respected, I think, neuroscientist, maybe, but he buys into, I think, panpsychism, according to which everything, and not just animate things. I think he says everything has some degree of consciousness. So I think, you know, bold theories of awareness are fine with me.
Let me read you a quote, if I could. And it's in the book I just read, but it's one that I want to emphasize here. In quantum mechanics, a subatomic particle is not created until it is observed, at which point it becomes formed. Before it is observed, it can best be described as a potential, not a discrete object. And the observation, consciousness, determines its final state. Niels Bohr, the great Nobel physicist, said, "When we measure something, we are forcing an indetermined, undefined world to assume an experimental value. We are not measuring the world, we are creating it."
Yeah. Now, that is one interpretation of quantum physics. Within that interpretation, there's an argument about whether, well, is it just a physical measuring device that brings reality into definite being, forces the wave to collapse, or is it actual consciousness? Is it actual awareness? And you're taking the awareness side of that argument.
I'm not taking it as a philosophical point. I'm taking it as a realization that, you know, that in my practice, this is what has been shown to me. And so, to me, it's not an argument. It's not one side pitted against the other. And so but it's not just, I mean, it's available to all of us. If we work it in alignment with the strategies that are needed, which are the strategies of some of the, they're in within most of the ancient traditions, we'll begin to find or sense that in ourselves.
Okay. Now, before we move on from not self, I want to move on to some things we kind of touched on earlier, like the formless. But before we move on from not self, I want to just take one stab at trying to get you to describe what it seemed like. You've done a little of this already, but what it seemed like to you from the inside maybe when you first started to feel you were experiencing not self, what was that like? Presumably it was while you were meditating, but maybe not. I don't know.
Okay, so in words, which already throws me way off, stillness. There was no contention, okay? Stillness was not a contained state. It was infinite stillness, because there was no distance. Infinity comes into play when there isn't any distance. Mm-hmm. It's the only time it comes into play. So when there is no object that is counter to yourself, or yourself that is counter to an object, then there is infinity. So I would say infinity. I would say stillness. And universal awareness, or you can call it universal consciousness. I tend not to call it consciousness, because when you call it consciousness, it forms another entity. Mm-hmm. And this isn't, the paradigm is not another entity that's formed. So, and it shows you without qualifications that we have been taking ourselves to be something that we're not. That's what it shows you irreversibly. Mm-hmm. And you get a sense of what has sustained, or what has held us since time immemorial. Mm-hmm. That there has been something back there that has held us completely. And I don't mean in any kind of biblical sense, or, you know, in the being held in the arms of Jesus. I don't mean any of that. I mean that there is something infinite that has always surrounded us, the limited, and that we just are so focused on the material forms of limitation that we miss this other. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if some of your listeners are in conflict with that, I would say, instead of protest, look and see. Is it true for yourself? I'm just inviting an inquiry. I'm not trying to establish an argument.
Okay. And are you, I think you'll tell me no. The answer is no. That I'm thinking of this in the wrong way, but
I'll do it like a Baptist preacher.
You will. Yes, you will. I think you're going to hate the whole way I frame this question.
That's okay. You say it.
But are you making progress toward this when, during meditation, you get to a point that I've kind of experienced where, you know, you're feeling something within your body, tingling, pain, whatever. You're hearing a bird from outside of your body, and you kind of think, it's not so clear to me what the difference is between those two.
Good.
Not,
yes, you're making progress towards that. I will use your words. I don't really like people who keep undermining the speech of how this is presented. Okay? Yes, you are making progress. When you become quieter inside, less protest, less resistance, you are moving towards the end of suffering. And you feel it in yourself. And so as long as you can say, you know, I'm suffering less, I'm more buoyant, I'm happier, You find you're moving in the proper direction spiritually. Mm-hmm. At some point, there's a threshold where the very sense of you is the suffering itself. The sense of me seeing life separate from me has a tension that begins to get your notice. And at that point, how you work with that changes the nature of how you have been working. That's all.
Okay. So you do accept what is in some ways a Buddhist teaching, that the source, or a source of suffering, is this delusion that you are a self or have a self.
Well, yes. Central to Buddhism is that premise. And I mean, Buddhism even defines dukkha or suffering in a number of ways. The final and most sensitive way it describes that is the sense of me being separate from. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm referring to, is that the tension of me being outside of life, thinking about life, but not really being at the vortex of where life is happening, there's a tension there. Mm-hmm. So you're always one step just outside of the living situation, pondering the situation, mm-hmm. reflecting upon the situation, thinking about the situation, but not really entered into the situation. That distance becomes an irritant. And when it becomes an irritant, there's a natural curiosity that says, what's going on here? That's creating this sense of distance from life. Mm-hmm. I want to know what life is from the inside out, not from some side mm-hmm. Position.
So then in theory, you must be a pretty happy person.
Yes. Yeah, I am a pretty happy person, yes. And there are still times when I get annoyed and irritated and all the other states of mind that come up. But it's framed. Those states of mind are now being framed in ways that there's not a strong personalization of them. Mm-hmm. That's the best I can do for that.
Yeah. And speaking of quiet, one thing I heard you say on the meditation retreat is that, when you have like an anxiety, okay, you feel guilty about something, maybe you feel fearful about something, our tendency is to try to talk ourselves out of it. So right. Like, well, it wasn't really your fault because after all, that guy did that. So it's right. Kind of his fault. Or you don't really right. Have to worry about this because probably what will happen is that.
Right.
You said that if you really obtain this place of quiet,
right,
all of that kind of, you don't have to bother with that.
Right.
To in effect dissolve the anxiety or the guilt or the whatever.
That's right. The anxiety exists because of the division in the mind of me being anxious. Anxiety is not something I want. I want to get rid of it. That divisiveness, that divided mind that we talked about earlier is the reason I'm suffering in relationship to whatever it's going on. So then the question is there a way to work with life so that it isn't divided, so that it isn't contentious, you say? And I'm saying, yes, there is. There is a way to do that.
And does it amount accepting the anxiety? Is the division between you and the anxiety the false division that you just need to let go of?
No. Okay, so the first half of the continuum, this is in my book, by the way, the first half of the continuum, we try to adapt our way into the states of mind. So as you said, here I am, I'm anxious again. I shouldn't be so anxious. I've been practicing for so many years. Okay, so let me release the tension in my body. Let me relax the body. Let me see what's going on in my mind. We do an adaptation, an adaptive response to the problem we perceive. Mm-hmm. We're making the problem real. Now, just bear with me. We're making the problem real because we are identifying it as something we don't want. And we're working with what we don't want to try to smooth over or make it easier. That's an adaptation, okay? So this new paradigm doesn't work in adaptive approaches. So just bear with me. It works with stillness. It does not resist. It doesn't try. When you're working in adaptation, you still have the eye talking to the mind in adaptive ways so that the eye can feel better about what's going on in the mind, okay? When you're working within the new paradigm, you cease any conflict whatsoever, bringing a unified quality of self and other state of mind, self and state of mind, within that unification, and the division drops away completely. And the problem is completely resolved in that unification. It's not letting go in the sense that I am efforting to do something in order. It's a simple wisdom, factor of wisdom that releases, or if I could use the word surrenders any objection or resistance to what it is going on. What you're surrendering is the act of separation. I'm mm-hmm. surrendering the need to be separate from the problem. This terrible problem that I've worked with my whole life, I'm surrendering the need to be separate from it.
So you're accepting it.
Acceptance is often an adaptation. Hmm. Now I'm accepting it. This is the elimination of you in relationship to a problem. Okay? It goes back to the central issue of anatta or selflessness.
Yeah.
You never were someone. Right. We just kept configuring ourselves in relationship to the problems that existed. If the problem and you can come together, and not be in isolated positions like boxers in opposite corners. You can meet in the center of the ring and there's only one thing going on.
What is that?
Awareness.
Okay.
Okay, so I know I lost you there a little bit, Bob. And
no. Well, I think, you know.
It's just not hypothetical. That's what I really want.
Well, right, but you're saying that as somebody who's been there. And I've talked to other people who say they've had the experience of no self. And it's no longer hypothetical to them. And I know it's something. It is a state that they've experienced that I haven't experienced. And you can argue whether it's a valid, accurate apprehension of reality or whether it's some kind of illusion. But it's something they've had that I haven't had. And I don't deny that. But it makes it easier to see what it means if you've experienced it, I think.
It does. And so much of the turmoil of the spiritual journey is working with this issue. There's no question. It's a very, very subtle issue. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say, just work in the direction, in my first book, Stepping Out of Self-Deception, I say work in the direction of interconnectedness. And at some point, interconnectedness will turn itself into selflessness. By interconnectedness, I mean, don't put things outside your life. Don't let the difficult divide you or separate you from itself. Just start bringing everything that's happening inside of you, because that's really what causes the separation. Just start acknowledging. Just start it, okay, so this, let me connect with this too. Let me connect with this thought. Let me connect with this emotion. That sense of continuous interconnectedness leads to the understanding, the discovery, and realization of not self.
Okay. That sounded a little like acceptance, though, the way you put it, which you said is not the right word earlier, but
okay, whatever. It's not the right word from no self. It is the right direction to take prior to that realization.
Okay, good.
Does that make sense?
Yes, then I am on the right path.
Yes, you are on the right
path. I'm on the path to salvation.
You are on the path to salvation.
I'm glad to hear that.
Again, I don't want in any way for this to throw you out of sorts. It's not meant to do that. It's just meant to show that there is a continuation here of the themes of whatever we've been practicing. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it becomes very important to practice in alignment to that theme.
Okay. So let's get back quickly to an idea you kind of alluded to at the beginning that I know is important to your thinking that you mention in the book. For example, when you say no one knows what a single thing is, and that is the idea of what you call the formless. And I want to emphasize this is not some kind of thing you invented. It's something you hear from Buddhists. From Buddhists in the Mahayana tradition, you sometimes hear it as the doctrine of emptiness. But it is to some extent the same thing. It's about this idea that you tend to think of things as having essences. That leaf has essence of leaf, and it's a skepticism about essence, among other things.
Right? You know, all of Buddhism is really meant to divest our energy from form, from formation, from forms. I mean, that's why we apply a Nietzsche change. That's why we apply a suffering, is because to show you that when things are outside of you, when you have when the material world exists as separate from you, there's going to be trouble. There's going to be agony. There's going to be tension. There's going to be conflict. Okay. So it's to divest the way that we impart energy to things, making them what they are. We make them what they are through our knowledge base, through our history, through et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Okay? So what happens to that energy? I like the scientific component here, is that energy always remains constant in any system. I think that's one of the thermodynamics. I'm not a scientist, but I like the way the interplay between the two. In any case, when you divest the energy from making objects things, what happens to that energy? And lo and behold, it goes to the formless. It doesn't stay within form. And the formless is the awareness we've been talking about. You get a sense of the awareness. I mean, if your listeners could just, or would just, with my speaking, quiet sufficiently, so that you're not investing in whatever it is that's being said in terms of argument, but just listening and just being quiet, suddenly you'll find that there is something else in the room besides yourself, something else that the sense of presence, the presence. And that presence is because we are no longer solely interested in the formations around us. So that's what has to happen. We have to divest energy in the formations in order for the formlessness to be seen. Now, the problem is that we're not very good at doing that. And so we make formed objects to represent the sacred, like crosses, like Buddha statues. Those are forms that are supposed to remind us that the sacred is close. But why not actually live within it rather than having a bunch of Buddha statues in your house? Why not actually live within that proximity of awareness by just understanding the limitation of what form can give us? Form will never satisfy us. Form will never be completely fulfilling. Mm-hmm. That's Buddhism 101.
Okay, so
go ahead.
When you talk about formless, you're not denying that the desk behind you in some sense exists.
No.
Or that leaves exist or cars exist.
But it doesn't exist as we know it.
Okay, so that's my question. I assume what you are saying is that given the perspective you have on this, your emphasis on the formless, as you go around the world perceiving these things we call desk and car and leaf is different than it would be for me, or at least different than it was for you back when you were a teenager or something. And I'm wondering if you can describe the difference. What's it like to go around the world really, realizing the idea of the formless, even as you encounter these things that look like forms?
Okay, so we just focus in on some form around you, for instance, like, eyeglasses or something or whatever. You're not going to get out of or get away from the knowledge you have about what it is that you see. That's impossible, nor do you want to. You want to be able to pick up a pair of glasses and put it on, not think it's a pencil that you're going to write with. Mm-hmm. Of course, you want the utility, the functionality of the world to continue. So it's not to try to get rid of that. It's to be quiet enough with that object so that it can be more than what we have said it to be. We say from us, from our mind, from our history, that this is a pair of glasses. If we're quiet enough, it's not that the history goes away. It's just that it's now surrounded by a quietude that shows that to be connected to things that we never perceived that interconnection when we made it something and only something. You see? So that you don't lose the shapes or colors of things. It's just that the spaces between them no longer divides.
Mm-hmm. Do you have less strong emotional reactions to some things than you might otherwise have? Do you invest them less with kind of emotional content?
That would make sense, wouldn't it? That if things weren't as substantial as you believe them to be, then your reaction to things would also simmer, you see? So that happens. You see, all the states of equanimity and all of those things come through the realization that things aren't what we thought they were. Mm-hmm. And that comes it comes in correspondence to knowing anatta. The quieter we become, the less we are configured or distinct, mm-hmm. the less the world holds its shape as well.
Mm-hmm. We should tell people that anatta means no self or not self.
It also means no world or not world.
Okay, as applied to as applied to other things, it means they lack a self, or in other words, they lack an essence.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And so to get a sense of how the world arises with me is a very important inquiry to have. Because when you realize that the sense of you is a fabrication, and you also realize what we've made the world to be is also fabricated. Mm-hmm. Now you get a sense of what the paradigm might look like if I were quiet inside, not reaffirming myself, then the world would also take that shapelessness, and it would be a quiet world, right? And it would be one in which there's a unification. Mm-hmm. So there wouldn't be a self that was having that experience, the sense of self would be a part of the entire configurative process. Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult to put this into language, and it's easier to be quiet.
Yeah. Well, I assume when you're talking to other people who have, you know, are really serious contemplatives who have done what you've done, spend their you know, months in Southeast Asia, whatever, you know, as monks, or just people who have done really, really intensive meditation, I assume that often, you know, like they're roughly on your wavelength. You say, you know, if you did say these things to them, they wouldn't have to press you for elaboration.
No, there's a common language. I mean, there's a common experience. Mm-hmm. No matter what tradition you come from, there's a common experience. The denominator is the same. You know, the numerators are all different. I'm Christian, I'm Buddhist, but the denominator is the same. And so there isn't a lot of controversy, I think, among people who have realized the truth of life. And if there is controversy, instead of staking a claim against something, wouldn't it be much better to inquire and see if it's true for you? If you inquire and say, okay, I don't know if what he's saying is true, but let me see. Let me see whether this sense of me, if there's a unification here that I have been denying, that is quieter and more complete and unifying than the noise and the conceptualization that I can constantly impart to things. Mm-hmm. And so it shows you it. It shows you that. You see, so this is a realized journey. Mm-hmm. There's no other way around it.
So you mentioned Christians, and I assume you're talking about Christian contemplatives in particular, although maybe you're not. So would they, in their language, would the experience of not self translate into the experience of unity with God or unity with the divine?
I think it would. I mean, that's one phase of not self. We haven't gotten into the phases of not self, but one of the phases of not self is where egoically you are no longer identified with the sense of being separate from egoically. And then that's where all the manifestations of union and oneness and, you know, being of God and all of that, that's where that comes in. However, there's still another phase of anatta or selflessness that comes in, and that's the sense of self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. That isn't itself an entity within consciousness, but has a reflective quality still active that sees from a self-conscious perspective. And that's the last phase of anatta that over time diminishes. Christians who have the sense of being a part of God are obviously the same as a Buddhist that claims a different reference or a metaphor for that. There's only really one way this thing can unfold. You're either going to force your energies into form, or you're going to allow those energies to show you the sacred of formlessness. I mean, it's only two directions. So if whoever is sincere in whatever tradition, if they start divesting that from the material world, like Christ said, don't lay up your treasures where rust doth corrupt or thieves let in, well, guess what? Then you see the kingdom of God in front of you. And I think Christ said, stay forever awake, for the kingdom of God is at hand. So he was intimating that same pathway. Mm-hmm.
So now you were brought up a Christian, right?
Episcopalian.
Mm-hmm. And you continue to relate Buddhist teaching, Buddhist experience, or you might say Eastern mystical tradition experience, to kind of Christian and maybe other Abrahamic experiences. Do you kind of make a point of that, or it's just natural given your background, or what?
No, I mean, I think that this culture is predominantly Christian, and I like to show that what they've been doing their whole life has not been wasted. You know, that the heart of Christ is really the same as the metta of Buddha, and that to start bringing in some of our history so you don't feel like you have to negate what you've done in order to add to what you're doing. Mm-hmm. They really, it does, it's accumulative over time. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I use Christian metaphors.
Okay. And we should say that metta means loving kindness in Pali, to a Buddhist. Okay. Well, I think we've been out this close to an hour. I could personally go on a long time, but it may be that our viewership would slowly diminish if we turn this into a telethon.
I think I lost him in the first five.
well, I doubt that. But is there anything else you want to say about your book, Awakening?
Well, it's not a book of argument. It's got a bunch of exercises interspersed in the chapters themselves, not the end of chapters, that take the point that's being made in paragraph to an experiential level. And I think that's one of its values. The other value, I think, is that it takes the arcane language and the mysticism out of the mysticism. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes it very practical and down to earth. And it doesn't require a special environment or a special training in order to access this. Mm-hmm. You don't have to practice 20 years in order to ask these questions of inquiry and self-searching.
Okay. It's being published by Shambhala, a kind of famous publisher of kind of mystical or kind of Eastern stuff. That's great. Okay, well, good luck with it. And thank you so much. And I hope this isn't the last conversation we have, because I haven't quite reached my awakening yet.
Bob, to us all. We all have a speedy journey.
Thank you. All right. Thanks a lot.
You bet.